You get used to things. They become habit, and it's what you've lived with, and you kind of take it for granted. I grew up in a church setting like this, and I remember the memories from my earliest days were of the Lord's Supper, that when the lids were taken off the trays, the room filled with the smell of grape juice. And I remember the sound, depending on whether it was store-bought matzahs or perhaps made by some of the members of the congregation, the sound of that breaking could vary anywhere from a slight crunch to a really solid ping as it was hard and shards would fly off of that. You could hear it all over the auditorium. Ping, ping, as they popped that off. And I remember the sound. It's only described by one word of the cups going back into the tray. It's a snick. It's a snick, snick, snick as they slid back. I thought about that today as what COVID has done to us. Now, when we take the Lord's Supper, it sounds like we're all opening cellophane packages from Amazon. You know, we're peeling back, and you hear the screech noise as it peels back, and you don't get to really smell that throughout the auditorium like you used to, because it's open quickly and consumed. But despite the fact that the sounds and the smells of that have changed, the essence of what we just did hasn't changed at all. Zach shared with us important thoughts about the Supper of the Lord. And it is that act on the part of our Lord that has made me your brother this morning, has brought us together as a family here. Our folks from Texas and people from Charlotte and other places, from Gettysburg and other places of the country. Yet we've all come here, and what we have in common may not be our socioeconomic backgrounds, or may not even be our political convictions, but what has brought us here is what we just did, the celebration of our Lord's death, burial, and on this day, his resurrection. Wow, I'm happy to be with you. Glad to be here this morning to see old faces and new ones. And I don't get to see all the faces. Ray came up to me and he had to introduce himself because I didn't recognize Ray just by his eyes, but recognized the voice. So nice to be with you. Thanks for letting me have a chance to not only worship with you, but speak to you this morning. And I want to share with you a story that I knew from the time I was a little boy in church settings. I remember my Bible class teachers pulling out, and this will take you way back. None of the kids are going to know this, none of them. But if you are anywhere near my age, 60s, or down to the maybe 40s or 50s, you'll know when I say, I grew up on Betty Lukin's flannel graph. Flannel graph is little cutout pictures of Bible characters, and the teachers would develop the stories by putting those up on a piece of flannel, and they would tell the story, and they would take down the ones and add them, and you would walk through the story. It was so primitive, and it was so effective. I knew so many of these stories that are in my Bible, because Bible class teachers shared those stories with us in that format. But the one that I want to look at with you this morning is one I could have told you the essence of from the time I was a little kid, because it fascinated me. But recently, I went back through, I was reading a book that brought me back to this whole story. The whole book was written about one chapter in the Bible. And as I was reading through that, I just was enthralled. I realized What I had done with that story for the most part was a thin reading, you know, pretty cursory reading of it. And when I got back into it and started looking at the wording and then started fleshing it out, it just opened up in a way it never has before. So I've developed five lessons on this one chapter and this one story. And Earl said, you can go as long as you want today. So all five, we'll probably get out about three or four. No, I'm not going to do that to you. I'm going to give you the first lesson in this series. It's brand new. I've never preached it anywhere. But I just, as I was reading it this week, I thought, oh, I can't wait to share that with the brothers and sisters who gather in Asheville, the city in the sky. It's in 2 Kings chapter 5. If you want to go there, I want to read it, and then I want to go back through and start taking it apart with you. 2 Kings chapter 5. Now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. And the man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. Now the Arameans had gone out in bands and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy. Well, Naaman went in and told his master, saying, thus and thus spoke the girl who is from the land of Israel. Then the king of Aram said, well, you go now, and I'll send a letter to the king of Israel. So he departed, and he took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothing. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, and now, as this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy. And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes. And he said, am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man is sending word to me to cure him of his leprosy? You consider now, and you see how he is seeking a quarrel against me. And it happened when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent word to the king saying, why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, and he shall know there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots, and he stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, you go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored to you, and you will be clean. But Naaman was furious, and he went away. And he said, behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and he went away in a rage. And then his servants came near, spoke to him. And they said, my father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? So he went down and he dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean. Now, I'm going to stop the story there, but the story goes on further, much further. He comes back to Elisha, and he's excited, and he offers him money, and he offers him the change of clothing, the stuff that he had brought. By the way, that amount of money that he brought, it is incredible. It amounts to about $4 million in money today. And he took $4 million with him. You know, we think our medical expenses are high today. Curing leprosy, Medicaid, Medicare can't cover it. $4 million he took, and probably a huge retinue. It's not just servants. You don't go into Israel, your enemy's territory, with $4 million and not have soldiers to protect you in that. The story goes on after he offers the money to Elisha, which Elisha refuses. Then comes the story with Gehazi, his servant. And that's the bad ending of the end of this story. But what I want to do with you is just take some lessons from the very first part of this great story. I want you to look at the description of Naaman in verse 1. And while you're looking at that, I want to kind of set the scene for you. Israel at this time is in a pretty rocky state. When I say Israel here, I'm talking about the northern kingdom. Israel, as we knew it as a kingdom, has divided. And now you've got the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And they're coexisting, but they don't get along. And in addition to them not getting along, there are all kinds of enemies around the borders who are constantly coming in and invading them. We can't even really relate to that at all. This idea that if you lived anywhere near a border, I want you to imagine, let's imagine that our Texas brethren who are here this morning, they live down near the border, the southern border, and periodically, huge Mexican raids take place where they come over the border into America, and what they do is assault a town, kill the men, loot the place, take all the money, all the food they want, whatever they want from it, take the children back and the women back, and horrible atrocities probably committed against them, and then just go back home, and you're left without any recourse at all. There's nothing can be done. They're raiding parties. And imagine the demoralizing effect that has on you as a people, as a nation. You never know when you're safe. Our middle daughter, Amanda, married Adam Olson. The Olsons are originally from up around the Minnesota area, and they are very proud descendants of the Vikings. Now, if ever there was a group of people that were good at pillaging, plundering, and raising a city to the end, R-A-Z-E, raising, lowering it, devastating, it was the Vikings. I mean, they every time they appeared, when their boats appeared, everybody fled. That's the story that is given here at the beginning of this. But it's told in such simple terms, we don't even really get a sense of the violence that is taking place. The Arameans are that kind of people. To the Israelites, the people of Israel, they're the Vikings. And this man that we are introduced to, I mean, it starts out with just now Naaman, like, oh yeah, you know who he is, but you've never met him before. It's not a guy you knew before. This is the only description we ever have of him. It's his only appearance in the entire Bible. It's a cameo appearance. But look at how he's described. And we read through this, and we read through it pretty quickly, and we may not get the sense first of the greatness of this man. Go back and look at it. Now, Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram. You need to know that the word captain, which in our military would indicate a mid-level officer, is the word that the Bible uses to describe a general. He is the captain. He's not a captain mid-level. He is the captain. He is captain of the army of the king of Aram. Get how important he is. Aram is more powerful than Israel. That is indicated by the fact that the raiding parties are successful. They go out in bands and had taken captive this little girl. The Israelites fear them. Look at the response of the king when he gets the king of Israel, when he gets that letter from the king of Aram. Look at how that letter is worded in verse 6. As this letter comes to you, I've sent Naaman, my servant, to you that you may cure him of his leprosy. There's not a civil note in that. There's not a statement in that that says, oh, king of Israel, I am begging you for your help and assistance. Would you please? There's no please. There's no thank you. There is only do it. So that tells you the power of Aram versus the weakness of Israel. Because the king of Israel says, oh, you see what he's doing? He's just looking for an opportunity to do what? Come against me again. And I can't do anything about that. I can't appeal to the United Nations. I got no help down there in Judah. I want you to see the power of the Arameans. And then recognize that this is the general of that army. That's how successful, that's how powerful he is. It's like these days, over the past few years, somebody introducing himself and saying, I'm the quarterback for the Alabama Crimson Tide. The Crimson Tide. Consistently number one team in college football, and you're the captain, you're the quarterback. Pretty powerful. This is the nature of Naaman. He's a man used to getting his own way. Everybody does what he says. He has power. But add to that. Captain of the army of the king of Aram was a great man with his master. And you may say, well, of course he is. He's a general. No, we've seen even in our own country, military men don't always get along well with political men. We've seen that over and over and over again. Perhaps the most noteworthy of that was Truman and Douglas MacArthur. Here's a chief officer in our military, and he doesn't get along at all with his officer. You would never have read of that MacArthur was a great man with his master, Harry Truman. You would never have heard that. They did not get along. But this man not only has military power, he's got influence. And that is also shown by the fact that he goes to the king, and he told his master, I want you to think about what he told his master. Imagine this. He's going to the king of Aram and he says, I got this little slave girl in my house. A little slave girl. She came from the Israelites and she says, there's a prophet in her land who can cure me of leprosy. And the king doesn't say, you're kidding. You are listening. You're a general in my army. You're listening to girls? And not just girls, little girls? Little girls. little girls believe in unicorns. They play with dolls. This little girl made a statement, and did she back it up? Did she prove it? Was she cured of leprosy or something? There's none of that given to us in the story, none of that. The power and influence of Naaman with his king is shown in the fact that the king takes his word for that and immediately sends a letter and bankrolls this cure in Israel. He is a great man with his master. And then look at the third statement. And highly respected. Why? Highly respected because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. Now, you are reading this from an Israelite viewpoint. I do not believe that people said about Naaman, he is great and to be respected because God is working with him. I don't believe they believed Jehovah was working with him. There are reasons for that. You go to chapter 8 and you'll see that the Arameans do not believe that God is God of all the earth. They believe he's a God of the mountains. He does well there, but he doesn't do so well in the valleys. They've got that restricted view that so many of those foreign cultures had about gods being over small dominions, not the world. But the point is, his win-loss record is really significant. He doesn't lose. When he goes into battle, he wins. And that's what gained them respect. Now, what he doesn't know, and what they don't know in the Aramean nation, what they don't know in Aram is God is doing that. But here's a man who has God working with him behind the scenes. Now, you may be wondering, why would God do that? Why is he working with the godless Arameans? He's punishing the Israelites. He's using him as a weapon. In this case, he's just a tool to be used against Israel. And we'll see God do that over and over again. He'll use the wicked Assyrians and the wicked Babylonians and the wicked Romans, and all those will be used to punish his people, to bring them back to repentance. But again, Naaman doesn't know that. All Naaman knows and all the people know is the guy's a winner and he wins. And one more. He was also a valiant warrior. You know, it was more common in the past than it is in the present that generals and officers went into battle with their men. We don't do that anymore. We send the young men into battle and the old men plan the wars. But in this day, you went into war. And sometimes they were good at being generals and sometimes they weren't. Sometimes they were good as warriors and sometimes they weren't. But this man, Naaman, he's tough. He's powerful. All right, so get the picture of this man. How valuable is he? What would you say about his life? How successful is Naaman in his life? And I think we'd all say, oh, he's up there. He could be man of the year in the Aramean version of Time magazine. Man of the year. Look at him. He's a warrior. He's powerful, single-handed in combat. He's an officer recognized above all others. Everybody pays attention to what he says. He sends raiding parties at will. How do you get that little girl as a slave in his house? He sent the raiding parties. He's responsible. And his master, the king, you mentioned Naaman. He doesn't go, well, which general is he? He knows him. He not only knows him, he treasures him. How much? He is willing to bankroll his cure to the tune of $4 million in silver and gold. So you're looking at Naaman's life, everything that's been said. And by the way, this story is beautifully told. Everything about Naaman we learn all the way through verse 1 up to this point is, it's good. He's got a good life. He's doing well. And then you get this word. If this were a movie, we'd be seeing, well, I'll give you a parallel. You remember the Disney movie Up? And it begins by showing in silent form this young man meeting this young woman, and they fall in love, and everything's going really well, and they're happy, and they're shown together. And then all of a sudden, you get a clue something's not right, because the tune and the tone of the music changes. And it starts getting dark. And the woman dies. You hear all this wonderful music in 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Everything's good. Naaman's got it together. He wakes up every day and he goes, it's a beautiful day in this neighborhood. And then it says, but. We've been going this way, and all of a sudden there's a but. We turn. What is it? What is it that happened? He was a leper. He hasn't always been a leper. That it came on him. The only reason we know that is there's no way he could have risen up through the ranks and been a leper. Once you're a leper, you're isolated. You're set apart. Now, it's probably in the early stages, but this is like some terminal diseases are for us. You may hear it, it's early stages, but you know what the fate is because it's incurable. You go to the doctor, you're suffering a little bit from unusual occasional tremors. And the doctor says, it's Parkinson's, or it's multiple sclerosis, or as a preacher friend of mine recently learned, it's Lou Gehrig's disease. No cure. Now, you may do okay for a little while, but you already know the end result. The end result is exit. You're leaving this earth. You are going to leave this earth. If you live long enough, you may die of something else, but that is going to kill you. Leprosy had that kind of aura. Now, there were some people who, in some cases, got over leprosy. We don't know how in some cases. In other cases, we know how because that was kind of one of Jesus' specialties. Curing people of leprosy. But unless you met Jesus or one of the apostles or an Old Testament prophet with power, unless that were the case, you were likely, once you were diagnosed with it, to die of it. And that same thing would have been true in Aram. Once he's diagnosed with leprosy, his fate is pretty well sealed. He is going down. It's only a matter of time before it erupts and breaks forth and shows itself visibly to everybody around him. It may just be a place right now he can cover, but in a short period of time, it's going to be made known. Now, I want you to think about that story. Think, here's this man who is incredibly successful in everything he does, who has all kinds of power and control, who controls his life. He controls his life. And now he has totally lost all of that. Leprosy will kill him. But even if it doesn't kill him soon, it will destroy the quality of life he has. He's lost quality of life. And this, in a way, that our cancers or our Lou Gehrig's disease or our Parkinson's doesn't do. When a person has Parkinson's, you don't tell them you can't be around your family because they could catch it. We have experienced to some degree that feeling with COVID. A member of the family gets it, we isolate them because we don't want other members of the family who may especially be susceptible to it to get it. So we isolate, but leprosy was always that way, always that way. If there's ever a time that you and I want the comfort of touch and relationship, it's when we are assessed with a terminal disease. It is almost ironically cruel that one diagnosed with leprosy is deprived of that. You don't get hugs. People don't come say, come on, give me a hug. Let's just cry on my shoulder. You can cry on my shoulder. I'm going to sit here next to you. I'm going to hold your hand. And we're going to be okay. We're going to get through this. We'll face this together. Not leprosy. Not leprosy. So at this point in the story, it's new enough and small enough and contained enough that Naaman is still able to walk among his family. He hears of the story of the little girl. What's left out of the story is the little girl told her mistress, and the mistress told Naaman, and then Naaman told the king. But you don't get the story of how the woman came to Naaman and told him about it, how he received it. But I would have to say he's probably grabbing at straws. He doesn't know what else to do because there is no known cure for leprosy. You can't go to Mexico and get new meds there that haven't been approved by the FDA. You can't do that. There's no cure for leprosy. And now he hears this girl say, there's a prophet. No, there is this one prophet in Israel who could take care of this. And he decides to do it. Now, here's a point I want to make with you. I know I've taken a lot of time to talk about this because I want to build this up to this point. How do we assess the tragedies and disasters that assault us in our lives? How do we assess those things? I'm standing before you this morning right now in good health. As far as I know, my doctors say I'm in good health. But what if tomorrow I go to my doctor and he says, Ralph, I see something really troubling. We're going to run some more tests. And they run the tests. And maybe one little thing that seems to be somewhat insignificant. Yeah, I've got this pain in my back. It's just one pain. And the doctor says, Ralph, that pain's really bad. I mean, that pain is the start of a terminal cancer we can't cure. How do we assess those situations? Because they happen all the time. In the past 2 months in our congregation, one of my fellow shepherds lost his wife in a tragic mishap in a hospital with a routine procedure that went bad and she died. In less than 5 hours from the time she started, she was gone. My dear friend is a widower. Overnight. And then a sister in the congregation who goes to the doctor with a somewhat troubling pain she's experienced for just a couple of days and goes in. And at that time gets a diagnosis that she has a metastasized cancer in the liver that is going to take her life within months. You know, we assess those things this way most of the time. Why me? Why did that happen to me? And I had no preparation for it. And we even use words like this. Everything seemed to be going so well, don't we? We use that kind of terminology. Everything was going so well. And then this. And I'm telling you, Naaman represents every person who's ever gone through that. And I don't know all your circumstances. Some of you this morning, right now, you're hurting deeply by the things I'm saying. And you are calling up memories that are so painful for you. And I'm not trying to rip those open, but I am trying to get us to see God's place in all of those things. I am not saying to you, God causes all those things to happen. There are a lot of circumstances that happen. Time and chance overtakes us all. That happens. Sometimes God is in it, but whether God is in the initiating of that, God must be in the dealing with that. And we need to understand that. So I want you to imagine a couple. And they've been married for a number of years. And they've been happy. They knew each other in high school. They dated through college. And then they got married. And he has a great career. And she could have taken a career, but she went home because they had two beautiful children. And the children are there at the house. And the woman is a stay-at-home mom. And she gets real involved in their school activities. She's very active as a volunteer in her community. And great social efforts. She's always there. He just got a promotion and he's doing really well in every aspect of his life. He is succeeding. Their neighbors love him. They're in a great neighborhood. All is well with them. They're putting away money for the future. And they don't really have much need for God. They never have. And then one day, something terrible happens. Or worse, nothing terrible happens. Because the odds are, if nothing terrible happens, they are not going to assess their lives spiritually. Had Naaman not had the "but" statement, he wouldn't be in our Bibles. And what happened to him, and I want to tell you, I'm not giving you all the lessons, but what happens to Naaman physically isn't nearly as important as what happens to Naaman spiritually. I can make the case easily that Naaman becomes a believer. But that would not have happened if it had continued business as usual. Naaman was a captain in the army of the king of Aram and highly respected because the Lord had given him victories, and he was that valiant warrior and lived happily ever after. If that "but he was a leper" was removed, Naaman would have died never knowing God. Nothing is more tragic than an apparently happy but godless life lived uninterrupted till death. John Newton wrote one of the most famous hymns that has ever been written, "Amazing Grace." Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. He's a wretch. In what way? Well, if you know the story, you know that John Newton was actually a slave trader. He was captain of a ship that brought slaves from Africa to America. And the life that he lived was horrendous, and he had troubling dreams about all of that. He was a wretch, but he was making good money. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. The balance. Lost, found, blind, see. And then this one in verse 2. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear. That's where Naaman is. That's where Naaman is in chapter 5, verse 1. He's afraid. But he wouldn't have been afraid if we didn't have the statement, but he was a leper. Wouldn't have been afraid. And it is only because grace taught his heart to fear that he will eventually know, and grace my fears relieved. He will only know that side because he's known the first side. You get it? You see the point? This is important in the life of Naaman. It's not a punishment. It's not a punishment. It may look that way, but it's not. I mentioned to you a few moments ago about this preaching brother who recently was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. It runs in his family. He's seen relatives die of it. So he knows how bad it's going to be. He is writing some of the most incredible things I've ever heard a preacher write about facing death. And his ministry has expanded in such an incredible way to people who are dying and grasping at straws of hope. And he is offering them as he faces his own impending death. He's a young man. He's got small children. He's not my age. He's a young man with small children at home, and he is facing death in a way that makes me marvel. Great preacher, wonderful family, but, he has Lou Gehrig's disease. Great general, very successful, highly respected, but he was a leper. Leprosy is so crippling as a disease. You need to see it. Look, turn with me real quickly to Leviticus chapter 13. I know we're not in Leviticus much. Leviticus is not one of our favorite books. It's the book that the coordinator of Bible class programs assigns to a teacher that he or she doesn't like. Says, hey, I want you to teach Leviticus, and you're doing that to the preschool class, okay? That seals it. I'm in Leviticus 13. I want you to look at verses 45 and 46. This is the fate of the leper in Israel. As for the leper who has the infection, his clothes shall be torn. The hair of his head shall be uncovered. He shall cover his mustache and cry. He has to cry, unclean, unclean, everywhere he goes. He shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. Now, I want to suggest something to you. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it, but leprosy has peculiar qualities that make it a very appropriate symbol of sin. The Old Testament prophets, as well as some statements made in the New Testament, make it sound like sin is a kind or form of leprosy. I'm not saying if you're a leper, you're a sinner because of that, or that God afflicts you with leprosy because you're a sinner. I'm saying some of these qualities that we just read here in Leviticus could very easily be applied to someone who is in sin. So look at this statement in Isaiah chapter 1. A statement in Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah, speaking for God, calls Israel to judgment, the judgment seat. And he says this in verse 5, Isaiah 1 verse 5. Where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? The whole head is sick. You remember the statements that were made about the leper? His head will be uncovered, his hair will be shown, his mustache must be covered. All of that idea, the head is kind of the central focal point of the leprosy. The whole head is sick, the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot, even to the head, there is nothing sound in it. Only bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, not softened with oil. In other words, you can't cure sin on your own. You can't. You can't. Any more than you could cure leprosy on your own. You couldn't go to a drugstore and get calamine lotion and put it on leprous spots and it go away. You couldn't go to a doctor then and get any kind of medicine that would make it better for you. You were a leper. We are sinners. From the soles of our feet to the tops of our heads, the whole body is sick. You can't isolate sin. You can't say, no, this finger did it. I got mad, that finger poked the other guy in the eye, but the finger did it. It wasn't the rest of me. The whole body is sick. Sin does that. Like leprosy, irreversible by its owner. We can't change it. That's why we came to this table this morning. Because Jesus can. All right, I'm going to bring it to a close. For a while, Naaman's leprosy had hidden itself. I mean, obviously, at some point, he contracted it. But it had lain dormant in him. And then one day, it erupted. He saw it. Maybe it was one spot on his arm. Or maybe it was something his wife noticed on his neck. But once they recognize it and they went to the doctor and the doctor says, leprosy, now it's only going to increase. He is blissfully unaware of its presence, but it will come out like sin. You know, so many times we live with sin in our lives and we don't think about it and then one day it erupts or it becomes clearly manifest. In our lives, we see it for what it is, and we can't do anything about it ourselves. There's only one great physician who can take it away. And here's my final point. This I come back to. I really only have one point for you in this lesson. That but statement becomes the pivotal point in Naaman's life. It's what wakes him up, breaks him up, and shakes him up to seek the cure that is found only in Jehovah. Now, I haven't been through what you've been through. And I don't even know what it is. Maybe you've lost your loved one. Maybe it was a child. Maybe it was a parent lost at an early age. Maybe you lost your job and you have no real hope of anything better. I'm not saying to you, I know exactly what you've gone through and here's how you have to handle it. I'm going to remove the statement, I know what you're going through. But I am going to tell you, here's how you handle it. You go to Jehovah. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, the Apostle Paul lays out for us this terrible situation that occurred in his life when this thorn in the flesh, whatever it was sent. It was no small thing. It wasn't a true thorn in the flesh. You can pull those out. This thing was so bad and so irreversible, he prayed three times that God had taken it away because he couldn't and nobody else could. So it wasn't a broken relationship that Dr. Phil could make better. And it wasn't a financial loss that borrowing money or getting money from the saints could help. Whatever he had, only God could take it away. And listen, here's what God said to him. My grace is sufficient for you. And his conclusion is, when I am weak, then I am strong. Not that he finds inherent strength in his weakness, but that he turns to the one who can make him stand. That's where Naaman's going to end up. But he was a leper is the first step taken in his relationship with God. Now, you may say, well, I've had a relationship with God. I've been a Christian for so many years, and this thing that's happened to me hasn't brought me to the Lord. I was already the Lord's. Okay, I get that. Can this situation drive you closer to the Lord? And I dare say it can. If you don't handle it that way, I don't know how you're going to handle the disasters in your life. Because they're going to come. They're going to come. The statistics on death are pretty impressive. George Bernard Shaw said, one out of one persons die. So how you face that, or how you face irreversible financial loss, or the destruction of relationship, if you don't turn to the Lord, I don't know how you're going to make it. Naaman shows us the way to go. Now, maybe you're here this morning and you're not a Christian. You're not a disciple. You've been listening to this and maybe some of it's made sense. Maybe it hasn't. If it hasn't, let's talk. Let's talk afterwards. Let's stay around and see what your situation is and what we can do to help you. There's a whole room full of people that would love to help you because we were helped when the Lord came to us. By his people, through his people, and through this word, we were helped. So we're willing to be here for you. But it may have made sense. You might say, I get it. I understand exactly what you're saying. What do I do? How do I turn to the Lord? Go to the Jordan River and dip seven times? No, that's not it. Though you're close. You come to the Lord, confessing him as your Lord. You come making a reversal of the life you've lived. That's seen in Naaman. And you do immerse yourself in water, not because there's power in the water, but there's power in obedience to the Lord who says, and now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized and wash away your sins. That's what the Lord said to Saul through his prophet Ananias. Maybe you're a child of God and you're going through this. You're saying, man, I don't know how you knew my life, but you just spoke it this morning. That's exactly where I am. What do I do? Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you share it with the rest of us and let us carry the burden with you. Let us pray about it together. If you have a need like that this morning, Zion's call is ringing, asking you to come to Jesus. Will you do that right now? Come while we stand and sing this song.